this morning is Ike Wedel versus Chandler, case 091031. Mr. Steinmetz.
May it please the court, my name is Kyle Steinmetz and I represent the appellate Paul Eichwalder in this matter. This case comes to this court on appeal from a denial of for a writ of habeas corpus based off the revocation of Mr. Eichwalder's good conduct credits. What essentially had happened is, in an earlier case, Mr. Eichwalder brought a 1983 suit challenging some of the conditions of his confinement in Dixon Correctional Center here in Illinois, arguing that his First Amendment rights to communicate with people on the outside had been violated and he had been punished in retaliation for exercising those rights. In the course of that case, which eventually survived a motion to dismiss and settled on the merits, Eichwalder filed a motion for sanctions in response to the state's motion to dismiss based off a misreading of materials provided for him in the prison library describing the screening provisions of the PLRA. That motion for sanctions was eventually deemed frivolous by the trial court in the 1983 action, and under an Illinois statute designed to punish, to prevent prisoners from filing frivolous litigation and decrease the amount of frivolous suits filed by prisoners, the Adjustment Committee of the prison revoked 6 months of his good conduct credit. There are basically two issues on appeal here. The first issue, and really the main issue in this case, is whether the Illinois statute, as it was applied to Mr. Eichwalder, complies with the protections for the right of access to the court and the First Amendment, as the Supreme Court has held. The second issue is whether the decision of the Prisons Adjustment Committee that was upheld through the appeals process by the Prison Review Board and the Administrative Review Board was supported by any evidence in the record, by some evidence in the record, and thus complied with the requirements of due process. I think the most important issue here is really that first issue, whether this decision of the Prison Adjustment Committee is in line with the right of access to the courts, or whether the rule that they established in that case unduly burdens the right of access to the courts. Now, there's definitely a clearly established right by the Supreme Court of prisoners to access the federal courts and bring 1983 suits. In cases like Bounds and Lewis, the Supreme Court has clearly held that the state must provide the prisoners with an effective and meaningful opportunity to challenge the conditions of their confinement through 1983 suits in federal court. Now, in cases like Bounds and Lewis, the Supreme Court has even gone so far as to put affirmative requirements on the state. The state must provide people with a law library, for instance. But that's not really what the case is here. The case is here is how far the state can go in punishing a prisoner if he brings a 1983 suit if he happens to make a mistake over the course of pursuing that litigation. And the rule there,
finding of frivolousness entails more than just a mere mistake. I think that's the material difference here.
I think the court found frivolous, but I think in this case there was a good faith mistake by Mr. Eichwalder. The materials posted in the prison library from Judge Mims' memorandum stated that under the PLRA, under the screening process, the court has to decide that there's a claim that upon which relief can be based. Now, in response to the 12B6 motion the state filed for failure to state a claim for relief to be based, Mr. Eichwalder read this memorandum and assumed it meant the same thing as it did in the 12B6 context, and that the motion to dismiss was therefore frivolous. Now, that's not right, but it was a good faith mistake, and it wasn't a motion that was willful or done with ill intent or any mens rea along those lines.
Well, that in the odd procedural context that we have this argument here, that's really a collateral attack once removed on the federal court's judgment that those Rule 11 motions were frivolous, because we have to back into it through the imposition of the discipline, which was upheld on mandamus by the state courts and is now being challenged here in a federal habeas action. So, it seems to me that determination of frivolousness is more or less unreachable now, and we can't second guess it based on your claim that it was really just a good faith mistake.
I don't think you need to second guess the use of frivolous as the court did to get to the question of whether this violates the right of access to the courts. The question isn't whether this was a frivolous motion or not. It's whether punishing Eichwalder for filing a motion based off a mistake of law, even if that's, you know, can be called frivolous in the district court, can comply with the protections of the right of access to the court. And I think whether it was done with ill intent or mens rea or anything along those lines is an important factor to consider when addressing the level of, the, of burden that's placed on level of burden that's placed on his right of access to the court, of his ability to pursue a 1983 suit in the federal courts to challenge the conditions of his confinement. And I think there are other factors that go into that question, to that question as, to go into that question as well. I think one of the more important arguments here is that this was just one simple mistaken argument in an otherwise well-grounded civil rights suit. Unlike other laws like the PLRA and other things along those lines that have recognized that we're here to deter frivolous lawsuits, Eichwalder was bringing a lawsuit that was well-grounded, in fact, well-grounded in law, and thus there is First Amendment protection here, and it would unduly burden his right of access to the court. I think another thing that's worth considering here, another thing that shows that this is unduly burdensome, is that just how much discretion this gives to the state to punish prisoners. This isn't a situation, if you look to the facts of this case, Eichwalder filed a valid lawsuit. He pursued that lawsuit and he made a simple mistake of fact. There's not any sort of limit on what this.
But this continued reference to a simple mistake of fact is counterfactual for our purposes here today, because the motions were denominated frivolous by the district court in the civil rights case. We have to accept that for our purposes, and that has a legal definition, and that makes it sanctionable under the prison regulations. And so I think we have to set aside your argument that he was really just doing his best and made an innocent mistake, and yeah, it was wrong, but it shouldn't be sanctionable. That's really off the table for our purposes. Now we have to focus on the First Amendment claim that's being made here, and we don't even have that. We don't even have plenary review of that because we're on habeas review.
Right.
So, perhaps you can back up a little and locate in the state court's decision some unreasonable application of Supreme Court case law on the First Amendment in this context, or an unreasonable determination of the facts.
Right. I think the unreasonable application is of the holding of Bounds and Lewis that there has to be effective and meaningful access to the courts. And I think if you look at how they apply that in the terms of regulations that would limit the access to the court, the question becomes, how far does this go in burdening the right of access to the courts?
So is this a facial attack on this regulation?
No, I think I think this can be done as applied challenge. Because of all the various factors that go into it, the lack of mens rea, the fact that he was making just one simple argument as opposed to an entire frivolous lawsuit, then the fact that this was, imposing longer jail terms as opposed to monetary sanctions, the fact that there was no recognition given to his status as a pro se prisoner, it's overburdening his original exercise of his ability to pursue that first 1983 suit. And I think there is an issue here that goes beyond Eichwalder's case, and that's that it's going to chill prisoner litigation outside Eichwalder's case.
Right. That's an overbreadth argument.
Right.
And also it seems to me that although you're characterizing this as an as-applied challenge, it really is a facial challenge because the regulation doesn't permit honest mistake defenses. It accepts the prior underlying finding of frivolousness at face value and doesn't permit the inmate to offer any defense to that to avoid the good time forfeiture.
Well, I think you're
is that your argument?
I think you're definitely correct that the regulation doesn't allow the prisoner to challenge the finding of frivolousness. And if you look to the record in this case, that was pretty much cut and dried. The district court in this case said that this used the word frivolous. That means that this is frivolous. I think the question is, can a rule like that that applies that type of punishment for a single frivolous argument as opposed to a frivolous lawsuit is that compatible with the First Amendment? And I think the as-applied challenge is that because H. Walder's underlying lawsuit was a meritorious suit, because it survived a motion to dismiss, because it was well-based in law in fact, and eventually settled for a motion to dismiss, this isn't Bill Johnson's restaurant, and it isn't the BE&K case. This is where there's no underlying First Amendment protection. His right to pursue that 1983 suit was still entitled to some First Amendment protection, and so we have to look if a rule that allows you to have your good time revoked for making a motion that's wrong and deemed frivolous in the trial court, it overburdens his ability to pursue that 1983 case.
Now, Mr. Steinmetz, this I know will move you into the due process realm a little bit, but tell me, at the time the disciplinary committee imposed this sanction, what did it know about the action of the federal court? It knew the judge had ruled and said that the motions were frivolous. Did he have given any reason whatsoever as to why they were frivolous at the time the Prison Disciplinary Board imposed the sanction?
At the time the Prison Committee imposed the sanction, the only two pieces of evidence in the record were the two initial orders that Judge Baker issued in the original 1983 action. One of those orders, denying his second motion for sanctions, was just a minute order that said this is frivolous and should be dismissed. The second order is a slightly longer order. It says this motion is frivolous. I haven't conducted screening under the PLRA, so that argument isn't well-bounded, in fact, in law. So there's a little bit more in that second one that explains why he thinks the argument is frivolous, but there's still no reference to the Illinois statute. There's no reference to any of the legal standards outlined in the Illinois statute. None of that was in the record before the prison.
With respect to one of those, did he said it was not well-grounded, in fact, in law? Is that right?
No, not at the time. He said it was frivolous. Not at the evidence that was in the record at the time the Adjustment Committee made their decision, there were just the two initial decisions that said this was frivolous. The first decision said this was frivolous because I didn't conduct a screening review under the PLRA. The second one was just a minute order. Now, there's a later order he gave that said this.
I understand, yeah. But at the time they ruled, then the Adjustment Committee had to make some kind of determination as to what the district court meant when he said frivolous, right?
I think that's correct. They were assuming that what he meant when he said frivolous fit within the scope of the Illinois statute as it was currently constructed.
So they made a further determination that the frivolousness of the motions fell within the ambit of the Illinois statute. Is that right?
I think that yes, they did. Yes, that's correct.
So they really were adjudicating here, weren't they? The actual substance of the pleadings that were offered in the district court.
I think given the fact that all you had in front of them was the minute order that said this was frivolous or...
In a way, the federal court had not, up to that time, adjudicated.
That's correct.
So they were really giving a legal characterization to a matter before a federal judge in a federal court that a federal judge had not given.
That's correct. Judge Baker had not made that characterization on any time on any other evidence that was in the record at that point. Okay.
And the statute, the Illinois statute, says that the court must make a determination of that the matter is frivolous and then defines frivolous.
It must make a specific finding of frivolousness as it's defined in the statute. And that's where I think really the due process challenge comes into play, that they were going well beyond what Judge Baker had already done and assume that these two brief orders that don't define frivolousness at all represent the specific finding.
Doesn't that raise the problem of whether the state Prison Adjustment Committee is in a position to make a legal determination based... which the state statute doesn't permit it to make.
I think that's
giving a legal characterization to something a federal judge hasn't done.
I think that's absolutely correct, and you're absolutely correct that the state statute doesn't do that, and that's where the due process violation is here, that the state statute requires the federal court or the state court to make that specific finding, and the Adjustment Committee can't go into the record and do it.
Then let's go back to my colleague's problem, though, is even if that's a correct analysis of the problem, how do we handle this in the context of habeas, given the state court's ruling in this case that we have to deal with? is it an unreasonable adjudication?
Well, I think in the due process context, it's an unreasonable application of the facts as applied to the Hill requirement that there must be some evidence in the record. And in this case, that goes back to what I think you're to this requirement of a specific finding that's an element of the defense. Now, and that, because there's that evidence of specificity in the statute, that needs to be supported by some evidence in the record, which means an actual specific finding by the state or trial judge. Because all there was in the record here is very general language, there's not that specificity here.
So in other words, there's no evidence in the record that the federal judge ever made the determination required by the state statute?
No.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Wong.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Assistant Attorney General Sherry Wong here on behalf of the respondent. To begin with the first issue, it's undisputed that Bounds and Lewis established that petitioner has a right to access the courts by filing a non-frivolous civil rights lawsuit. And petitioner here, he was not denied his right to access the courts. He filed his 1983 lawsuit. He was able to pursue that litigation until it settled. Petitioner's good conduct credit in this case was not revoked because he filed that 1983 lawsuit. It was revoked because during the course of litigating that lawsuit, petitioner filed two motions for sanctions that the federal district court found to be objectively frivolous. And petitioner's argument here depends on this sweeping proposition that so long as he filed a non-frivolous lawsuit, the state of Illinois can't revoke good conduct credit for objectively frivolous pleadings, and they're indisputably objectively frivolous pleadings that he files during the course of the lawsuit, and that's an extremely broad proposition. And petitioner has presented no established, clearly established Supreme Court precedent that demonstrates that there is a First Amendment right to file objectively frivolous pleadings in a non-frivolous lawsuit. And in federal habeas review, that's the question. Carey versus Muslin and Wright versus Van Patten make clear that if the Supreme Court has not clearly answered the question in a federal habeas case, let alone answer that question in the petitioner's favor, he's not entitled to federal habeas review. And here the question is there a First Amendment right to file an objectively frivolous pleading in a non-frivolous lawsuit? And petitioner has never cited a Supreme Court case that stands for that proposition. Bounds and Lewis don't stand for that proposition. Petitioner said so as much during his argument this morning. Bounds and Lewis talk about a prisoner's right to access the courts, but Bounds and Lewis were discussing affirmative obligations that prisons have to take in order to ensure that prisoners have the right to access the courts. Bounds and Lewis don't talk about whether or not states can revoke good conduct credit for the filing of objectively frivolous pleadings. Bill Johnson doesn't really talk about this, but in fact, what Bill Johnson does is it says that objectively frivolous litigation is not protected by the First Amendment. So given that holding, it was not objectively unreasonable for the state trial court to extend the Bill Johnson exception to objectively frivolous pleadings in this case. Bill Johnson said that objectively frivolous litigation is not protected by the First Amendment, and the state trial court, thinking that objectively frivolous pleadings are similar enough to objectively frivolous litigation, said that that is also not protected under the First Amendment, so we're not going to reject your claim on the merits. With respect to petitioner's claim in his brief that Bill Johnson just talked about knowingly intentional frivolous claims, that claim was specifically rejected by this court in Geske. In Geske, this court said that Bill Johnson's, although it listed knowingly intentional frivolous claims as an example of a claim that is not protected under the First Amendment, that was only an example of a claim that was not protected by the First Amendment. The court's subsequent discussion in Bill Johnson makes clear that what the court was referring to was the class of objectively frivolous litigation. And as Your Honors noted, petitioner here was not punished for making a good faith argument. His good conduct credit was revoked because during the course of litigating his 1983 lawsuit, he filed two motions for sanctions that the federal district court found to be objectively frivolous. Petitioner could have made his argument regarding the district court's granting of IFP status in a reply to the defendant's motion to dismiss. And in that case, the federal district court probably would not have found that reply to be objectively frivolous. But what the district court found to be frivolous in this case was the petitioner's filing of the motions for sanctions. The district court specifically noted that it had reviewed the defendant's pleadings in this case, or in the 1983 lawsuit, and had found nothing sanctionable about the defendant's conduct. So that is what the good conduct credit here was revoked. That's why it was revoked. It was not revoked for the filing of the 1983 lawsuit. It was not revoked for the claim that was the basis for the motions for sanctions. It was the motion for sanctions itself that was found to be objectively frivolous.
How did the prison disciplinary committee know that when the district judge said these motions were frivolous, that he meant they were frivolous in the terms used by the Illinois statute to define frivolousness? He made no reference to the statute and apparently made no explicit reference to any of the criteria in the statute.
The evidence that was before the Adjustment Committee was Judge Baker's two findings of frivolousness, his orders finding frivolousness. And although the evidence regarding Judge Baker's later discussion of his viewing of frivolousness, which is, you know, lacking an arguable basis in law or fact, that was not before the Adjustment Committee. That demonstrates that Judge Baker intended for the term frivolousness to have its commonly understood and well-established meaning. The dictionary definition, the Illinois state law interpretation and federal court interpretation of the word frivolous is lacking any arguable basis in law or fact. And that's what, even though that specific finding was not before the Adjustment Committee, all that was needed for the Adjustment Committee here to revoke petitioner's good conduct credits was the district court's...
Why was Judge Baker so careful when he gave that third ruling, which is not in the record of the disciplinary proceeding, to say he was not making any determination as to whether his use of the word was the same as that of the Illinois statute?
Well, that's true that he did say that, and it's not clear from Judge Baker's order that he intended for his findings of frivolousness to result in the revocation of petitioner's good conduct credit. But what Judge Baker did say in that later order was that it was frivolous in that it lacked an arguable basis in law or fact.
In that order he did.
Yes. In the later order.
In the later order, which is in the record.
That's correct. But there's nothing in the Illinois statute that says that the federal district court judge must intend for his finding of frivolousness to result in the revocation of petitioner's good conduct credit.
No, but is it? But the finding of frivolousness, it would seem, that is made in the district court must be made on the basis of one of the three possible definitions of frivolousness in the Illinois statute. And that's what we don't seem to have here.
Well, what the Illinois statute says is that the Adjustment Committee must find evidence of there must be a specific finding of frivolousness within the meaning of the statute. And here the district court found the motions to be frivolous. There is no Illinois law that says that the Illinois statutes require more than what the district court found in this case.
Ms. Wong, let me tell you what I'm concerned about here, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Frivolousness, yes, it usually has a dictionary definition. But it is used rather loosely in legal parlance. If you were to go through the motions issue practice of this court and look at the word frivolous used by some members of the court in motions practice, it would be very hard to say they were using this definition or the definition in 1950 of the federal statute. They just mean there's nothing to it as far as they're concerned. That's the way it's used. What I'm concerned about is a United States district judge, very busy, a lot of motions on his desk, saying, gets one of these things, says, oh, this is frivolous. Doesn't go through the analysis of saying it fits any one of these things. And he just took away a man's good time like that without realizing he ever did it. Because your people are going to say, I use the word frivolous, and they're going to cut this guy's good time out from under him on the basis of what the district judge meant, had no intention that be the consequence of his action.
Well, that's what the Illinois statutes allow for it, because it only requires...
No, the language says that the court has to enter an order of frivolousness as defined here.
Within the meaning of the statute, that's correct.
That's right.
But the Illinois cases, the Illinois courts have not defined that particular term, specific finding of frivolousness within the meaning of the statute, to include any of the particular pieces of evidence that petitioner is alleging is required here. Petitioner is alleging either that it requires the definition of frivolous in the statute or a citation to the statute, but no Illinois cases have interpreted the Illinois statute in that way. And this is a question of Illinois state law that is not cognizable on federal habeas review.
Let me put it to you another way. We worry all the time about habeas around here, about, you know, not getting in the way of district judges. I'm worried here about a prison disciplinary committee sitting in Pontiac or someplace, getting in the way of the ruling of a U.S. district judge and ascribing to it a meaning the district judge never meant it to have. So let's talk about interfederalism and comity the other way for a minute. Doesn't your view of how this statute should be implemented, as opposed to the Illinois legislature's, all right, allow the prison disciplinary committee to play fast with federalism and step on the federal judge's toes?
Well, the Adjustment Committee, there is a level of discretion at the Adjustment Committee level. I mean, petitioner can make these arguments to the Adjustment Committee that this was not a specific finding within the meaning of the statute, and the Adjustment Committee can consider that at the hearing where his good conduct credit can be revoked.
They can say, we don't care what the district judge may or may not have meant. We've examined the pleading, and we think it's frivolous for one of the reasons in the statute.
Because under the Illinois statute, the Adjustment Committee is interpreting the statute to only require
that. That's proper respect for the determination of a federal district court.
I think it is, yes. I mean, I think that because there are so many levels of discretion here, the Adjustment Committee considers this.
And that is the position the Illinois Attorney General is taking before this court today, that is appropriate expression of comity. Is that correct?
Well, I think this is an issue. It's an issue of state law. The question of whether or not there is this finding of frivolousness within the meaning of the statute, as interpreted by the Illinois cases, that's a question of state law that on federal habeas review this court does not review. The state trial court in this case reviewed Illinois case law and determined that the finding of frivolousness in this case was sufficient to satisfy the definition under the Illinois statutes. And that question of state law is determinative of this question on federal habeas review. So it does take into account your concerns about federal comity, because this is a question of state law that this court does not review.
I understand the position. Thanks.
I hope that answers your
question. That's very helpful. Thanks.
I mean, again, to address your concern about whether or not the Adjustment Committee is taking this prisoner's good conduct credit. Again, there's a level of discretion here. Petitioner was eligible for 6 months of good conduct credit to be revoked for each violation, but in this case, petitioner was only 4 months of good conduct credit were revoked for the first violation and 2 months for the second one. So obviously, the Adjustment Committee is doing a level of review and is exercising discretion when it revokes petitioner's good conduct, when it revokes a good conduct credit for a violation of the statute.
Right, but that's not the issue that we've got. We've got an issue about the interpretation of the Illinois statute as it intersects with what federal courts do on a regular basis in adjudicating prisoners' rights claims, and that's what presents the difficulty here. Do the Illinois courts interpret the question of frivolousness under this statute as a question of fact or a question of law?
I think it would be a question of law. They're interpreting the Illinois statute and determining what that term specific finding within the meaning of the statute means. And there's no Illinois case law that says that term specific finding requires more than just a district court saying that the motion that was filed was frivolous.
Okay, so all the Illinois courts interpret this statute to mean that all the Adjustment Committee at the prison has to do is take note as an evidentiary matter that some court somewhere has entered a finding of frivolousness against the inmate.
Yes.
Is that how the statute is interpreted?
How it works. At the state, when petitioner presented his claim to the state trial court, petitioner was able to make this argument that the only thing that was present in this case was the district court's finding of frivolousness. And there should have been more than that in the order. But the state trial court specifically rejected that contention because it interpreted Illinois law. Its interpretation of the Illinois statutes did not require anything more than that. And
what's the point of the statute's inclusion of a detailed definition of frivolous?
Well, I think that the distinction would be if the district court had found that the motion had been meritless. If the district court had said that, then there's no way that the good conduct credit could have been revoked upon that finding.
Right. We lawyers and judges know the difference between something that's frivolous and something that's meritless. That language is generally used, or at least attempted to be used, with some care. That's not the distinction that's drawn in this statute. And that's why I'm trying to get at what actually has to be proved before the Adjustment Committee, before it can exercise its discretion to revoke good time. And your position is that the Illinois cases stand for the proposition that all that has to be proved as an evidentiary matter, factual matter, not a legal question about what is or isn't frivolous, but as a factual matter, is that there has been an entry of a finding of frivolousness against the inmate in some court action somewhere.
As long as it is a state court, yes. As long as it's an action filed by a prisoner in a state court or a federal district court against a Department of Correction or Illinois official, yes, that is all that would be needed. And just to clarify, there are no Illinois cases that interpret the statute, no published cases anyway. So when the Illinois state court was making its determination here, it was using its own interpretation of state law. And it found that based on its reading of state law, nothing more was required other than the district court finding the motions to be frivolous. There was no additional definition that was required.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Steinitz. I'll give you a minute for rebuttal. You were out of time.
I think I used all my time. I think I just want to focus real quickly on that element of specificity that's required in the statute to prove up the due process violation. I think if you look at what the state's saying here, they're basically saying that any time a court uses the word frivolous in any manner, if the Adjustment Committee says that's okay and meets the standard, that meets that specific finding of frivolousness that's in the statute. But if that's the case, there's no reason for them to make it a specific requirement, to make that specificity an element of the defense, and to provide, as you said earlier, a very detailed definition of frivolousness that labels the specific cases where this might apply. And I think that's really where the due process challenge comes into the place. Given two very scant orders, whether that's sufficient evidence to meet even the sum evidence standard under Hill, and because there's no indication in the record that Judge Baker gave any thought to the Illinois statute or gave any indication that he was meaning to use it as it's defined in the statute, it can't meet that element of specificity, and for that reason, it's an unreasonable.
That can't be the rule, that the judge who enters the finding of frivolousness has to have the good time revocation statute in mind.
No, but he has to, I think, give some indication that he meant to use frivolousness under one of the ways it's defined in the statute at a very minimum.
That can't be the rule either, that the judge has to announce that this finding of frivolousness meets the definition in the state statute for revocation of good time? Is that what you're proposing as a rule?
He would have to have indicated in the record that it was baseless in law and fact or one of the other definitions.
Okay, use the language in the definition.
Language in the definition to meet the specificity.
And that, in fact, is being done by other district judges in the Central District of Illinois, is it not?
I believe so, yes. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Our thanks to both counsel and Mr. Steinmetz. You were appointed in this case, were you not?
Yes.
Yes, our thanks to you for your representation of your client and your assistance to the court. The case is taken under advisement.